Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. Hi everyone, thanks so much for your company. Today we're joined by Beck Guild, a naturopath who looks after science communication at My Brain Co. And today we'll be discussing safeguarding your patient's brain health. Welcome, Beck. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you so much for having me.
It's an awesome pleasure. Now, unfortunately, we're talking about a very sad topic because this affects many, many people, and it is absolutely horrific what happens to people's mental state as they enter into mental decline. So to start off, how big is the topic that we're talking about?
It's big. So we're obviously talking about cognitive health, but what I find a lot of people don't realize is just how big of an issue it is in terms of how prevalent it is as the cause of death, especially in our country. It's the seventh leading cause of death in the US. However, here in Australia, it's the second leading cause of death, and that is dementia. And that includes things like Alzheimer's disease and Lewy body disease as well. So, you know, to put that into perspective, that's about 10% of our deaths annually in this country. So it's a really big issue that I think will probably surprise a lot of people.
Absolutely. I had no idea it was that high. I thought we had cardiovascular disease and cancer before then, at least.
Wow. No, actually, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, if you follow them on LinkedIn like I do, they post some amazing graphics. And they've actually just put out 3 weeks ago the one about the leading causes of death on the 2022 statistics. And you'll see that coronary artery disease is the leading cause of death. But the second to that is dementia. And then, you know, going down the list, there's third COVID, cerebrovascular disease, which is loosely related as well. But some of the other metabolic aspects of disease are also going to be related and probably accumulated to contributing to the disease burden that we have with dementia.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Wow, that's incredible. Okay, so risk factors. We have to talk about those. What are some of the risk factors and maybe some of the signs and symptoms which practitioners need to be aware of?
So the first thing that practitioners probably might be thinking is, well, and maybe not always practitioners, but some of the consumers that might listen to your podcast might be thinking, hang on a minute, how does dementia cause death? So let's talk about that first, because we think it's a disease of forgetfulness because that's the most common way it shows up, especially in the early phases. But the most common way that someone with dementia or Alzheimer's disease will pass is due to pneumonia. Now, that's both from an aspect of a weakened immune system that occurs over the development of the disease, but also because Alzheimer's disease puts them at a much higher risk to have a loss of control over their swallowing, and then they can aspirate their food and drink, and then that can lead to infections, which they will often not have the capacity to overcome. And then, you know, obviously there's a lot of other aspects to that, loss of motor function, loss of bowel, bladder function, you know, basically anything that the brain is trying to communicate with the rest of the body can start to deteriorate over time. And that has some very real effects. So those risk factors, obviously the older you get, it's far more common in people over 65. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's also, I would kind of put in the vein of like preventative areas of health, like high blood pressure, high blood sugar is a risk. The diabetes and insulin resistance have a really close connection with brain health. Being overweight or obese, which also goes hand in hand with being sedentary, so a lack of movement or exercise is a risk. High alcohol consumption, smoking, and that would include vaping. And then one of the other risk factors as well is, you know, a history of social isolation or depression. Those are the most common.
So we're really looking a lot here about those let's say, the anti-blue zones, social isolation, so no social
network
use is the network. Thank you. Lack of activity, and we're not talking necessarily going to the gym, but activity. It's really interesting how the blue zones contribute to longevity, and they are, you can quickly just do the anti things, and there's your leading causes of morbidity, mortality in the Western world.
Yeah, well, and interestingly, looking at some of the facts and figures, is some of the highest risk populations are those that live very remote. So they're probably more isolated by design, and also people in the city. So those two kind of in between. But if you're in like out of regional areas, your risk is a little bit lower than city dwellers or really remote regional areas. So that, I thought that was an interesting statistic.
Yeah, the lonely population in the bustling city. From a naturopathic perspective, what's fueling this scourge? You've mentioned a few that we seem pretty obvious, but let's go into that.
Yeah, so I mean, from my perspective, I think that some of the factors to blame or the things that are making this worse fall into three categories. So number one, exposures. Number two would be the microbiome. And number three would be the metabolic disease state. So for example, even compared to 10 or 20 years ago, if you consider the sheer amount of things that we're exposed to on a daily basis, as far as heavy metals, mold spores, volatile organic compounds, organophosphates, pesticides, you know, anything like that, that we're exposed to on a daily basis, cleaning chemicals, anything like that. It can be through your job. That has some very real risks. Even a Lancet commission on the effects of air pollution have been shown that that could be a contributing factor to cognitive decline as well. And then, I mean, I probably don't need to spell out the connections with the microbiome to listeners on your podcast, because I feel like they would be very well educated. But obviously, there's a lot of aspects to modern life that disrupt the microbiome. So antibiotic use, again, pesticides and organophosphates in our foods, chemicals that we're exposed to, those also impact our microbiome population, which, you know, there's a really close connection. There's a trillion microbes residing in your gut, and they're communicating directly with your enteric nervous system and via the vagus nerve. So they have an influence on our mood neurotransmitters, your glutamate, dopamine, you name it, they have an influence. And so if we're talking about long-term brain health, the microbiome, that's why I sit that there as the second point. And then metabolic, yeah, I think, again, it's going to be no secret to your listeners that systemic inflammation, uncontrolled blood sugar, obesity, stress, problems with your vascular system, nutrient deficiency, you know, they're all going to have a role to play in what our neuroinflammatory burden is.
I think if I could wave a magic wand, it would be for stress. And if we could take away stress, we could take away so many of the other modifiable factors on so many disorders, not just brain health. But we'll talk about what we're going to be using to help these patients in a tick. But things like when you're talking about stress and microbes, exposures, things like that, and metabolic disease, I feel that stress, maybe not for exposures, but stress certainly can affect our microbes. Stress affects our sleep, which affects our microbes. Stress affects our metabolic health, which affects our microbes. So we end up not just I had this conundrum, and I posted this the other day, but the conundrum was stress and other factors affect our microbes. Does that mean that you can intercede at the microbe level to alleviate stress, or do we really have to look at the bigger picture and say, no, we need to exercise, we need to sleep, we need to maybe talk to a counselor, we need to talk to a friend, get a dog, you know, all of those sorts of things that will take that huge emotional psychological burden off you so that the microbes can then communicate with the highway, with the vagus nerve and the neural highway.
I think stress as well, because it's unseen It can sometimes be an untangible thing. I think if you ask most people, they'd say they're stressed, but you can't physically see right now. You can't see I'm stressed if I'm, you know, well, hopefully you can't, but you know, everyone is operating daily under some level of stress, and the level of it varies and it's unseen. So it's one of these underlying unthought about factors that probably has a lot more to blame than we think. But yes, yeah, there's a deep connection with microbes and, you know, the effect on our mood. I mean, even just recently, I mean, it's surprising that this hasn't been looked at until now, but there was a study published just a few months ago, back in June, and that was looking at the connection between a dysbiotic gut and whether someone goes on to develop Alzheimer's disease. And they're starting to look at, you know, can we use the microbiome as a way to screen people for Alzheimer's disease risk? So that's an area that I think will only continue to grow. And that, I mean, the microbe, gut, psychobiotics, all that thing, you know, that's probably worthy of its own podcast.
yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go into how can practitioners best intervene?
Yeah, well, I think number one is awareness, because, you know, if you don't realize how big the issue is, it may not be something that we're thinking about, but the brain is the control center of the whole body. So we want to make sure that, you know, we are thinking about it and keeping it top of mind. I have some hacks or some strategies we'll go through in a minute, but, you know, assessing if brain health is a risk for your client would be something to think about, you know, those risk factors that we talked about earlier, but then looking for those early signs and symptoms, you know, forgetfulness, losing or misplacing things, a change in mood or behaviors, difficulties with problem solving and decision making, even changes in vision can be some early signs. So, you know, just being aware that those things exist and having some ideas in place about what you could do to intervene. Family history would be the most obvious one, but, you know, asking questions around exercise and movement and fresh air and breathing and that kind of thing, these all have a role on brain health. Checking blood sugar would be an absolute hallmark, making sure that you're keeping on top of that. And then the other fact is, you know, looking at nootropic herbs and ingredients that actually support brain health, but also support other aspects to health as well.
Okay, so let's start off with behavioral stuff. So, you know, we can easily say get people moving, but really easy thing for us to say, particularly when those practitioners are movers, they're already fit. But when they're talking to somebody who has already fallen into that pit of they are now sedentary, we have to get them out of that. So what sort of simple things do you start with? Do you talk about joining a gym or a walking group, or do you start with just moving in the house?
I think that for me, if I was talking about, you know, what's the low hanging fruit, it's walking. Honestly, and walking outside in the fresh air. And if we want to talk about the connection with brain health and well-being, that is also an important aspect to that, is those sets of circadian rhythms. So walking in the morning, ideally early, so 6 a.m., that kind of thing. Dr. Mark Hyman posted just this week on one of his social media platforms that a Lancet study looked at over 47,000 participants over 7 years and showed that walking can decrease mortality. So, I mean, you don't have to go and join a gym, and you don't have to lose, you know, shed tons of kilos and build tons of muscle, but you do have to be moving. And I think walking is completely underrated. It's such an important thing. And the fresh air and the sunshine also add to that.
Yeah. So we've got a quandary a little bit, I guess. There's the morning walk, waking people up, getting the, you know, melatonin down, if you like, the adenosine down, preparing for the day, for the day's activities. Then you've got another important nutrient that's important not just in metabolic disease but also in protecting neuronal health, and it's vitamin D. And you don't get that with morning walks. So you've got to spend some time at midday or between 10 and 2-ish, and not all of that time, safe sun exposure, please, everybody, but some small amount of time, whether that be 5 minutes or, you know, in summer, or 15, 20 minutes, half an hour in winter, depending on where you are in latitude. Check with your cancer council. But certainly that walking is important. The other thing is also, what about after a meal, walking after a meal to help with metabolic stress?
Yep. And the impact that it has on the flow on effect to blood sugar as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And
with regards to exercise, you and I were talking off air before about this doctor who was, I think she wrote a book called Forever Strong. That really interested me. Can you take us through just a little bit about how important maintaining muscle mass is?
Yeah, so that's a book by Dr. Gabrielle Lyon that I've recently come to come into my knowledge. I hadn't heard of this doctor. I hadn't heard of this book, but she's got my attention because her line of thinking is that we're not necessarily suffering from an obesity crisis in the sense of too much weight. Her thought process or her narrative change is we are under muscled, not overweight. So, which is really interesting. It's that whole chicken or egg scenario. If you don't have enough muscles, you aren't going to be as efficient at burning calories because you're going to have less mitochondria. But then on top of that, you know, it's the physical strength and it's the other kind of metabolic benefits of having extra muscle mass. So I haven't gotten her book. It's something I plan to get my hands on and learn a bit more about. But I just thought it was a really interesting narrative shift from, you know, the whole we must lose weight and that's the main goal.
Yeah, eat less. Yeah. I really take your point about that mitochondrial number. Because a lot of the ways we intercede in clinic is we go, okay, well, let's, you know, give you something for energy, magnesium, CoQ10, da, 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 da. Those all work with mitochondria. If they're not there, what are you working on? You're trying to work against this very active inflammatory endocrine organ called fat, called fatty tissue. Yeah. And so we really underestimate the power of that with driving inflammation, driving hunger. So it's keeping them in that sedentary spot, that sedentary pit. And it's no wonder that, you know, one of the biggest obstacles to people losing weight is they're too tired.
Yep. And then, yeah, and the really kind of harsh truth is that the more you move, the more energy you are capable of creating. So, yeah, you just have to get started and then inertia takes care of the rest.
Yeah, so it really does. It answers that big question about, you know, how people say just get moving and you'll feel more energy. I think this is the reason that there are more mitochondria there.
And I think something that a lot of people probably don't spend a lot of time thinking about as well is that the health of your mitochondria have a really strong connection to our brain. Like the brain demands nearly a quarter of the daily energy output that your mitochondria is producing. One quarter. So, you know, if you think about every meal that you sit down to, one quarter of that plate is just functioning your brain, making sure that you can think, respond, you know, make choices, split second decision making and all of that. So as our mitochondria and our muscle levels decline, you can see why people are feeling fatigued, mentally fatigued. They struggle to, you know, pull points out or remember and recall things. And then if you compound that with a lack of sleep, again, you could talk about sleep in a whole separate podcast, but it's a massive risk factor for health, for brain health, because the brain has to consolidate memories and put them, like kind of file them away whilst we sleep. And if we don't get into the deep quality sleep that we need to make that happen, then we can't do that. And then on top of that, the brain detoxifies when we're asleep. So any toxins and things we're exposed to that make their way into through that blood-brain barrier, you need your glymphatic system, which is what's activated when you're asleep, to be functioning. And if you're not getting enough sleep, then that's not happening as well. So anyways, I think that's another underrated risk factor for brain health.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a point that I forgot about stress, and that is the coping mechanisms of stress. So stress is not bad in and of itself. When we exercise, we're stressing ourselves. When we're waking up and going for a walk in the morning sun, it's actually a mild stressor, but it's preparing you in a healthy way for the day. It's this unbridled chronic unwavering, smoldering stress. So unlike, I used to use the analogy of the zebra that gets away from the lion. You know, a zebra, once it gets a whiff of lion, it's off, it's taken off. There's no holding that animal back. And it will run and run until it cannot sense that danger anymore. But then it's used up by the facility of it actually running and getting away. It's exercise. It's used up that adrenaline, those things that just normally sit with us because of our smoldering stress. And it then can then go back into a meditative mood and go, "Ooh, grass, great." So it's straight back into the peace mode. Yeah. We don't get that with our modern lives. And that's one of the things we need to mildly stress our bodies above the normal smolder so that we can come back down and get rid of the smolder later on.
Absolutely. I totally agree.
There was a really simple way of talking about a technical, which, God, I use stupid, simple words. Beck, let's go into more of these things that practitioners can help their patients with cognitive decline. So cognitive health, I should say. So one of my favorites, and I do want to talk about what I'm going to lead into, one of my favorites is phosphatidylserine. And I've even gotten citicoline from overseas, but that's because of gene SNPs. Do we talk about gene SNPs in a whole other podcast?
Yeah, probably. You could talk for days about the gene SNPs.
But we need to include our preponderance for, you know, PEMT SNPs and methylation issues and things like that in this discussion. So what other things? Like I just mentioned phosphatidylserine. Take us through that. Take us through some other things that we can use to intercede.
Yeah, well, so any herb or nutrient that serves to improve cognitive function is termed or known as a nootropic. So for anyone who might not be familiar with that as far as a term goes, I know I wasn't familiar with it until probably 8 to 10 years ago. So it's probably a newer term. I don't know where it came from. I tried to look it up, but the only information I could find is that it's kind of originated from combining Greek words for mind and bending. Cute, good information to know, but I didn't know who created it. But nootropics will support your memory and learning, your focus and motivation, stress resilience and stress response, mood and creativity, motivation, that kind of thing. And they do that through a few mechanisms. They can have a brain regenerative effect, so perhaps increasing neurogenesis, the creation of new nerves. They can improve blood brain supply. So as I mentioned, you know, before that 25% or a quarter of your energy needs are demanded by the brain. So the more you have improved circulation to the brain, the more you can facilitate that. They might also facilitate brain energy. So work through mitogenesis for mitochondria, mitoneurogenesis, I believe that is. And they can also modulate our neurochemicals. So, you know, acetylcholine would be one of the targets that is what phosphatidylserine is working through, but also GABA. What's happening with glutamate? What's happening with dopamine, serotonin? These all have an impact, and nootropic herbs can often impact one or many pathways. One of the wonderful things about herbs, right? The multiple modes of action. They can also influence brain waves and those sleep-wake patterns, that kind of cycling. So nootropic ingredients is something that we can employ as naturopaths and herbalists because we might be also looking for something that does this but also does that. So I'll give you an example. For instance, we were talking about phosphatidylserine. So not only does that get incorporated into cellular structures, which improves nerve communication pathways, if your cellular structure is intact, it's well nourished, it's well fed, for want of a better word, then, you know, messages can travel from one end to the other much, much faster. But it also has some evidence, phosphatidylserine, for helping how the body deals with cortisol. So when cortisol is up, it can help with bringing that down. So, you know, some of the great things about these nootropic ingredients is these multiple methods of action that they can employ and that might also spill over into some of the other aspects that we're trying to help our patients with in practice. So for instance, with that one, if you've got a really stressed patient who's got brain fog and they're really struggling with their tasks, or they're not keeping on top of their schoolwork or their work at work, their paperwork, their administrative work, you know, that could be something that would be highly, highly beneficial.
A little anecdote about phosphatidylserine. I can still remember, I will always remember, doing ClinMed with Dr. Edwin Nicol. Dr. Edwin Nicol, you were amazing. And my notes were constantly half finished. I would constantly have to, after every lesson, I would have to go to the library, look up somebody else's notes and finish them. I was always behind in the thought processes of that lecture. Mm-hmm. And upon taking phosphatidylserine, so an important thing is think about loading dose first. So it's like 400 milligrams a day for the first month odd. So it can be quite pricey in the first month, but after that, it's only one or two per day. So it just drops significantly.
Yeah.
Upon doing that loading dose, not only was I keeping abreast of his thought processes, not only was I taking clear notes and complete notes, but the interesting thing is that I was ahead of him. I was asking questions and Edwin would say, hang on, I'm about to get to that.
Yeah.
If there's a nootropic, that's it. It was like, it was kind of like that Limitless movie. It was I was amazed.
But now, it's the speed of those messages that changed that for you. Like another ingredient that is has got some actual science on that, and I think is a completely underrated nootropic ingredient, is astaxanthin. You know, that they've got science that show that astaxanthin improves the speed of the messaging. And not only that, because of the way it functions, it protects the cell from the inner layer to the outer layer, and it supports mitochondria and like, it's an incredible ingredient.
So this seems to be kind of like sort of what phosphatidylserine does, in that phosphatidylserine can sometimes be flipped, I think I've got this right, to the outside of the membrane, cellular membrane, in which case it can be bad, i.e. we're talking about apoptotic dysregulation.
Okay.
But when you supplement with phosphatidylserine, it flips to the inside of the membrane, and that's got to do with cellular or intracellular communication, making its own chemicals for communication then to the outside world, i.e. to other cells. So similarly, the astaxanthin might work in the same way in that
possibly
respect.
Possibly. I mean, the way I read the research I was reading was it becomes vertically integrated into the cellular structure, and so it improves that lipid bilayer, and then that, through improving the cellular integrity, that's going to make you more resistant to lipid peroxidation and free radical damage and that kind of thing. And then the other thing that it does is it helps to potentiate other antioxidants that you take around it. So whether that be vitamin C or luteolin or, you know, anything, it can help make those work more efficiently, which one might assume that if you took phosphatidylserine with astaxanthin, it'd probably make it work really well.
Wow. Now, you were mentioning herbs before. I'm going to rattle off a few. but you know, things like one of my favorites is American ginseng. Another one, how could I go past lion's mane? My goodness. But the old faves, bacopa, ginkgo, biloba.
Yeah, I mean, you can't
really. Can
you take
us through these?
You can't really talk about nootropic ingredients without talking about ginkgo and bacopa. You know, ginkgo obviously hailing more from a TCM perspective. It's meant to be one of the oldest species of plant on the planet. It's about 1,400 years old. Is the oldest ginkgo plant in a temple in China. It's always been used to support memory recall, but you know, science has then gone on to showcase the ways in which it exerts that action, you know, everything from improving neurotransmitter systems, supporting neurogenesis, so the making of new brain cells. It also helps with that circulation and blood flow aspect, which I think is a really important piece to the puzzle. Like, it's great to take in all of these nutrients, and if you've got an exemplary diet, great. But you know, you still have to get it to your tissues and to your peripheries for those nutrients to exert those functions. So I love ginkgo for that. There was a study that did show that ginkgo with phosphatidylserine could improve increased memory task performance as well. So I think one of the great things with nootropics is the more you stack them together, the more you can get these beneficial outcomes. It's also one of the few herbs that I can think of that's gone up against the leading Alzheimer's disease medication. I don't know how to pronounce it, donepezil, something like that. But yeah, that it acts through enhancing acetylcholine pathways in the brain, and ginkgo is shown to be, you know, closely as effective.
Right. Okay. That's quite an amazing thing, like to have research backing it up. I mentioned American ginseng before, and you just talk about task orientated things. I have a dim memory. Obviously, means I need to take some of this stuff, but with Siberian ginseng as well. So there's all of these ginsengs, but I am a fan of American ginseng because it's a more calming, I call it the mind ginseng. There was some research done years ago with ADD kids even on a fractionator product. I am a big fan of that.
Polysaccharides in your ginsengs that help with memory function. It can be really hard to access, especially American ginseng, and a bit more on the expensive side than some of the more mainstream ones. But yes, it would also be one of my first thoughts, particularly, yeah, like you said, with ADD, but with kids, because it from everything I've read, it's quite gentle.
Yeah, absolutely. There was some really good work done, actually. Her name was Deborah. Cannot remember her last name. I remember her first name, Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, but it was 2010 maybe. Mm-hmm. And she was looking at chemotherapy-induced fatigue, but it only worked after 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to take 2 grams per day. Didn't work after 1 month. So you had to just settle in and just say, I'm going to give it 2 months before I look for an effect. But it's really annoying me that her last name, she presented it at ASCO, and what she was amazed by in her research was the safety profile of this ginseng. So you know how you get people going, oh, no, you can't take a herb because it's going to interact. She was saying, no, it's extremely safe, this herb. Mm. So that's one. The other one I forgot to mention previously, holy basil. Any work on that at all?
There probably is, but I haven't committed a lot of it to memory. But I know Mark Cohen is a massive fan of holy basil. And I remember when I listened to his podcast years ago, I was like, wow, how have I never heard of this herb?
I thought it was hilarious that the topic was actually about the wellness industry. And then we went off on Tulsi. And he has been integrative in me procuring my own holy basil plants. Yeah. And now I take them regularly. So I just snap off a leaf or two every day.
Yeah,
so
and
what
I think
other...
it more operates in that kind of stress response adaptogen aspect, more so than necessarily, like you would get cognitive enhancing effects from that 100% because you're decreasing the body's response to stress. But I don't know, or I haven't seen anything around specifics of it in studies anyway, showing cognitive enhancement.
Well, something, a herb that has done that is ashwagandha. Particularly, what is it, the KSM-66 extract? What about that one?
Yeah, KSM-66 have done a lot of work with their clinical research profile. But a lot of people, again, might think ashwagandha, I'm going to give that to my really stressed patients. I always tell people that, you know, ashwagandha or withania, it's like giving somebody a warm hug.
Yeah.
In a herb, but it does have some very real science on cognitive improvement, like and in as little as 8 weeks as well. So I'm thinking about one randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study was just in 50 adults over the age of 35, but it was shown that it could so they were getting 300 milligrams per dose twice daily or placebo, and they found ashwagandha very effective for immediate memory, general memory, and improving that executive function, attention span, and information processing speed. So much like you were talking about before with phosphatidylserine. There was another systematic review that showed that it could, that ashwagandha can improve your performance on cognitive tasks, executive function, attention, and reaction time. And that study also pointed out that it was well tolerated, great great compliance and minimal side effects, which I think is an important one. And then another study, it's sort of adjacent to, but still related in terms of its impact on neurological conditions, that got my attention was a study looking at ashwagandha and Parkinson's disease, and that it found in that study that it has this potential to rescue mitochondria and therefore help with ATP. So when we're talking about brain health, you can kind of see why perhaps it's getting these functions, is because if we're improving ATP, and remember we need a quarter of it for our brain, then, you know, that's why it's probably getting some very actionable aspects to improving cognitive health.
Gotcha. And now we did mention, and we have to go into this lion's mane. And I must say, lion's mane as a fluid extract is an interesting taste sensation.
Is it? I haven't tried it. What's the taste like? Is it taste mushy?
Very mushroomy. So I'm trying to figure out a way that to like maybe mix it into, let's say, mashed potato or stew or something like that to help it have that more, what's the fungus that hogs sniff out?
Like truffles?
Truffles, you know, it's more like a truffly taste then.
Okay, so, well, that's quite a strong flavor. Well, I don't know, but I love that lion's mane has, you know, it looks like when you look at it, it's looks like a hairy brain. It's shaped like a hairy brain. So from a doctrine of signatures perspective, I think that that's a really interesting part. But it's always been used as kind of a vigor or cognitive enhancer, you know, throughout its use in Chinese and Japanese cultures. But it's been found to have neuroprotective qualities. There was actually a study just really recently, and it was out of the University of Queensland, published in the Journal of Neurochemistry. So, you know, that they found that it has a significant impact on the growth of brain cells and therefore improving memory. You know, they showed in lab tests that it could do that. So kind of really confirming the science. And then there was another study that I'm thinking of that came out in 2020, looking at its use in Alzheimer's disease with 1 gram of lion's mane mushroom daily for 49 weeks, that it had a significant improvement in cognitive test scores as well. So I think as what happens with most entropic ingredients is those effects are cumulative over time. So that was quite a long study, 49 weeks, like just under a year. But I think you would see
that's
that
great.
The effects would deepen with time. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's actually a very good thing to see, because we're often restricted, and I get research, you know, you've only got so much money to support the research over so much time. But, you know, when you get these studies that are over like a 4-week period, but you're really talking about a chronic disease state, 4 weeks is a snapshot. It's only going to get that. And that's why it's really interesting. Deborah Barton, I just remembered her name. When Deborah Barton did her work on the American ginseng, it was over 8 weeks. We're talking about the 8 weeks, and now this is over 49 weeks. If you've got placebo, you will lose it over that 49 weeks. So if it had a continued response, there's a very good chance that it's due to the active intervention rather than a placebo response.
Well, and that's the thing, cycling back to astaxanthin again, which is probably up there with one of my most new favorite ingredients. But, you know, that has shown impact in the elderly with cognitive decline, an impact in their, you know, multiple parameters, let's call it, of cognitive thinking in as little as 12 milligrams a day over just 12 weeks. They could show changes in cognitive function. So, you know, some of those things, some of the herbs, you know, I think with Bacopa, a lot of those studies are kind of longer term studies, over sort of 6 months or more. But again, those improvements in cognition deepen with time. So yeah, I think anything, and then like I said before, the more you stack your nootropic ingredients together, I think the more profound the effect.
Gotcha. We have to talk about methylation, B vitamins, folate, B12, B6, and maybe some other simple nutrients. Any that you advocate, any that you might even be cautious of, maybe too much iron?
Yes, too much iron that's underutilized is a risk for brain health for sure. However, Iron is the most abundant mineral in the brain, second to zinc. So zinc is very important. And B vitamins, yes, because of their function in how we go on to produce ATP, the way our body uses B vitamins is really, really important. And then I guess the way I look at it is that methylation can potentiate or gum up the process. So the biggest risk there would be if you perhaps do have a gene that is impacting your folate pathways, which then in turn can have a spillover effect on things like B12, which is really important for cognition. So, you know, if anything that's influencing your B vitamin status is going to have an impact as well, a spill on impact to how well nourished and how well your body has the capacity to generate energy, which is important for the brain. Because I say it once, I'll say it again, your brain uses a quarter of your energy.
Any other herbs that you think that you can think of?
Two things that come to mind. One would be rhodiola. We often use as natural for its adaptogen qualities, but it does have some science that backs up its cognitive enhancing effects. You know, that it can improve cognitive function, reduce mental fatigue, help with free radicals, you know, have an antioxidant impact. There's a study I was reading that was saying that rhodiola is thought to act through antioxidant, cholinergic regulation, antipoptotic activities, anti-inflammatory, improving coronary blood flow. So again, that vascular aspect, cerebral metabolism. So, you know, that it also can, this same study also said that it can improve learning and memory. And I thought this was really interesting, but some important things that rhodiola can do that will additionally benefit the brain. It's been shown to significantly increase glutathione, and that it can increase levels of NADH and NADPH. So, you know, again, with this whole energy, fueling the brain's energy needs and also protecting the brain against neuroinflammation and free radical damage, which is, as a fatty organ, it's highly susceptible for. I thought, you know, it's one of those, I probably use it for, you know, stress, but hey, look at all this cool stuff it does for protecting brain health.
Yeah. Beck, circling back to one of the factors that you spoke about at the beginning, exposure. If we're talking about, you know, heavy metals, these, I hate this term, but anyway, forever chemicals. What a narrative to dampen down or to placate us into thinking that it's not toxic, these forever chemicals. I mean, wow. These are endocrine disruptors. These sit on so many receptor sites and disrupt so many metabolic processes. We're going to become not the robot cyborgs, but the plastic cyborgs. But so when we're talking about exposure, what about some of those nutrients that can help reduce the exposure or get rid of those chemicals that might be already in us, like NAC, for instance?
Yeah, NAC is a great choice because it helps with
glutathione,
superoxide dismutase, like it boosts those endogenous antioxidants that are absolutely critical for how we quench free radicals in the body. And, you know, it's got so much interesting science. Like, you could just do a podcast just on N-acetylcysteine.
My mind's going elsewhere now. So here we go. So we're talking about not just protecting against exposure, with the glutathionation and other processes with to do with biotransformation or detoxification, whatever you want to call it, but also metabolic health. So broccoli sprout extract.
Yes, absolutely. Broccoli for that glucuronidation pathway, and the sulfur aminos are super important for, the cross-linking of proteins and heaps of stuff.
So, you know, we're talking about the sulfur linking, and then now my mind's going to diet. So we're going West Mediterranean diet, or can other diets, like, for instance, keto diet, can they be of use, even if only short term, to sort of pull somebody's mental state up?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the body will preferentially, particularly the brain, prefers to use ketones for energy even over glucose. Yeah. So if you've got like a patient who is experiencing, you know, brain, mental fatigue, brain fog, that kind of thing. And you can see already from, you know, and tests and things that you've run that they're having some very noticeable insulin resistance, blood sugar, that kind of thing. I would definitely be considering ways that you can help them to adapt to a more ketogenic style of eating, boosting protein. Like I think protein is another completely forgotten aspect to all aspects of health, but mood, it's so important for the mood because we get those physical building blocks of neurotransmitters that we have to go on and produce from amino acids. And if we aren't eating or we aren't exposed to enough of them, then, you know, of course we're going to be at a deficit for creating some of our happy mood chemicals or, yeah, you know, the ones that might have a counterbalance to excess cortisol and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And although it is important to note that protein intake or any food intake has to be utilized. So there's no point having protein and sitting on the couch expecting it to put on muscle. That ain't the way it works. I've tried it and no.
Yeah. No, you still got to have a healthy gut.
That's a healthy gut, but also some exercise to utilize those nutrients as well. As you spoke, we go back to those mitochondria.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
It's all like a stack of dominoes. One thing will have an impact on the other. But yes, there's a gut-brain connection for a reason. A lot of the things that our brain needs to function have to come first from what we're eating. It has a very real impact.
Absolutely. So, Beck, any safety issues that we have to be aware of? So here's one that comes to mind. There was one, two case histories saying that ginkgo caused subarachnoid bleeds. I'm sorry, but, you know, you may as well walk across the road and expect to be hit by a car every single time. These case histories that have been taken or these case studies that have been taken and then it becomes a narrative for a side effect concerns me. Mm. And what concerns me is the agenda behind who's saying that narrative. Mm. What are the real risks of any of these herbs? We've been saying again and again the safety of them. American ginseng, Cybe ginseng, rhodiola, amazing safety profiles. Mm. Any risks that we have to be aware of?
Well, I mean, there's always risk. I think the biggest risk would be in those who are already perhaps, you know, in a situation where due to whatever reason, and it might be often it's chronic metabolic disease, and they're already on polypharmacy and they're already probably, you know, experiencing a range of fluctuations and side effects as a result of this kind of polypharmacy model that they're in. If someone's on a mixture of, and I see this a lot, you know, this comes in through our channels at My Brain Co a lot, where people ask, you know, I've got this medication, you know, can I take this? And that's a really difficult question to answer when you don't really know all of the information about that particular person's health. You know, what are they eating? Where are they living? How are they living? You know, what are they taking? What are they taking it for? Which one came first? In what order did they start the medication? You know, what side effects, if any, are they experiencing? Like, it's such a complicated topic, but I find that oftentimes people will be taking like antidepressant medications, and then they often go looking for something that can help to offset some of those effects. And it might be brain fog, or it might be a ruminating mind, or it might be associated insomnia. And so I would defer actually to our friend Tracy to, you know, go really deep and look at the pathways that they operate on, and just make sure that when we're applying these herbs with patient groups that are on those medications, that their doctor is aware, that they've been told to make their doctor aware. You've made it really clear in your clinical notes that you've told them to do that, even provide it to them in writing. And then that protects you as a practitioner as well.
I think, firstly, who's Tracy?
Tracy Blythe.
Gotcha. Tracy Blythe, of course. Co-prescriber. Of course. Co-prescriber. Yes. Brilliant work, Tracy, by the way. One of the things that springs to my mind, and if only for a litigation protection Routine would be to be cautious of those people on anticoagulant medication, because I think the real risks occur when you're trying to prevent, or you've got to be aware of, a catastrophic thing. Things like anticoagulant medication, and it's not necessarily real. It's that you don't want to be that bunny, because sure as heck, they won't blame the medicine. They'll blame the herb.
Yeah.
We've seen it so many times. We've seen it just recently with curcumin, where an 83-year-old gentleman was on naproxen, had acute liver failure, and the DAEN database of adverse event notification says naproxen not suspected. Hang on. If you look up side effects of naproxen, it's a rare side effect, but acute liver failure is one of them. And that's indeed what this gentleman died of. How can you not suspect it? There's a narrative going on there that concerns me greatly.
Well, yeah. And yeah, you have to be, obviously you have to be aware of those kinds of things and be on top of it, because if you look through the DAEN, there's a lot of things that say, oh no, it can't be that. But then it does make you feel puzzled, because you're like, hang on a minute, that's a known side effect. Like, how did this not get picked up, for, particularly for medications? But yeah. Definitely case by case. It's hard to quantify that into individual herbs, because there's lots of what ifs.
So to wrap up, if we're thinking about the generalities of helping somebody protect their brain with therapy, we're talking about first things: eat well, sleep well, exercise well, as much as practicable, and start off with something. And even if that's in the home, start off with something that will improve your muscle mass, even if it's bending or squatting, kneeling, or something.
Yep.
Then what else? How would we stratify the next sort of thing? Maybe, you know, a nutrient profile with good fats in it.
I mean, we didn't even cover good fats, but they're completely important to the structure of our nerves and the function of our brain. I would say, yeah, get your diet right. Like you said, get your diet right. Try to avoid processed foods, preservatives, you know, fortified foods too. I have a problem with those, because I think they add nutrients in poor forms that are unnecessary, that probably don't do brain health any favors.
Right.
So avoid those. I think definitely address sleep. Sleep is the freest nootropic medication that you can get. And if you're not doing it well, then start figuring out how you can, because it's a massive risk for your brain well-being and your longevity. Get that correct. And then, you know, if you've addressed diet and you've addressed exercise and you've addressed sleep and you're still experiencing some, you know, cognitive issues, you're experiencing brain fog, or you'd like your mental acuity to be faster, you know, that kind of thing, then add in, you know, quality protein sources, you know, boost up those protein levels. Maybe we didn't even talk about this, but MCT, because it's a brilliant fuel for the brain. And then you've got these cognitive enhancing antioxidant herbs and nutrients that protect brain health, support nerve function and structure, help build better, more neurons, more nerve cells, more quality brain matter tissue, that kind of thing. You know, so you can add them in as a layer. But if you don't have, those fundamentals right, if you don't have your diet looked at and you're addressing your diet, you don't have your lifestyle looked at and you're addressing that, your sleep and you're addressing that, then you can throw all the cognitive nootropic ingredients you want at it. It'd just be like tossing them down a hallway for no benefit. You need to make sure that the fundamentals and that foundation is right. And then you'll really see the impact that nootropic ingredients can have on top and over and above that, because then you'll start to do like you did with before, where you're like, hang on, I could keep up with my lecturer, or I could do this, or I could do that. You've got to be well fueled and well rested to do that.
Salient points. Beck, thank you so much for taking us through some of the more important points of protecting your patient's brain health today. I so appreciate it. You are a wonderful person, and you have always have wise words. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's always good to chat to you.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us. Remember, all of the other show notes will be down on the podcast notes, and we'll put it up on Natural Medicine Partners as well. Thanks for joining us. See you soon.